The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. This evening, I'm going to start a series of talks on the five hindrances. Five hindrances is a very important list of mental qualities, mental states, that have a big impact on meditation practice and have a big impact on people's daily lives. And in our particular tradition of mindfulness, we encourage people to become very familiar with these five hindrances. The word hindrances has a negative connotation, and so that raises issues in people's minds. More literally, the Pali word for hindrances means the coverings, that which covers over. And it covers over things like the clarity of our mind, our ability to be mindful. It covers over, still a little bit of a bounce here. It covers over our ability to be wise. It covers over our ability to get concentrated. It covers over our ability to stay on purpose. And so somehow we have to contend or deal with these as we kind of develop meditation practice. It's very important not to see these as personal failings. All human beings have them. And it's a huge part of the process of mindfulness meditation and concentration meditation is to learn about these really well so that you become free of them, so they don't have to hinder you anymore. It can be easy to want to dismiss them. These are unfortunate, they're distractions. But it's actually better not to dismiss them too quickly, get over them too quickly, but rather take these things and study them, become a student of these, so you understand them really well. And when you understand them really well, then it's much easier to set yourself free from them. So these five hindrances are... There's a narrow list of what they are, and then there's a more expansive one of what they are. So I'll do the narrow one first. Sensual desire for sensual pleasure, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. But often they're kind of expanded outwards to include other things which can function very much the same way. So sensual desire is sometimes referred to the first hindrance as just simply desire. Because desire, any kind of desire, not just sensual desire, can derail you from your practice, can obscure your ability to see clearly. The ill will is sometimes simply called aversion. Sometimes any kind of aversion, even if you don't have hostility towards someone, wish them ill, there can still be very powerful forces of aversion that kind of pull us into their orbit, and it's hard to get out of them. They influence us quite a bit. Sloth and torpor. Sloth is physical and torpor is mental. Sometimes expanded outward to be any kind of lethargy, any kind of drop of energy where it makes it hard to be present. And then restlessness and remorse. Remorse is not a popular topic here in the West. And so we like to talk about anxiety a lot more. So restlessness and anxiety or restlessness and worry are talked about a lot here in the West. And doubt is usually just called doubt. So these are the five. and they can be very mild forces in the mind. And they can be very powerful forces in the mind. Seemingly on the mild side, the ability to have clear insight meditation, to have clear insight into your life, or your ability to get stably concentrated is contingent on having these put to rest. Not getting rid of them once and for all, but letting them kind of drop long enough so the mind can see clearly or get concentrated. And so in very deep meditation, or relatively deep meditation, pretty quiet, pretty still, the mind can still be wandering around and little bit. You're kind of staying on the breath, you're pretty well on the breath, And then suddenly you start thinking about how good it would be to have chocolate. You know, and oh, yeah, chocolate would be really good. And, you know, there's that orange chocolate, raspberry chocolate, you know, and you're, oh, yeah, you know, they just, you can kind of feel it, you know. And it takes a while to realize you're not on the breath. So your mind's been pulled off very subtly, but enough so you're not on track. Or very subtle aversion can arise. Normally in daily life, the desire for chocolate may not be such a big deal. But in deep meditation, it's just enough to kind of nudge you off course. A person can be calm, pretty quiet, and it doesn't take much to nudge a person off a little bit. And so you have to be very attentive in meditation to notice how the mind might drift off this way or that way into these different states, how these states influence you. In daily life, these five hindrances can be mild, but they can also be phenomenally strong. So strong that people die. Strong addiction to sense pleasure, any kind of addiction is kind of usually seen as kind of a strong attachment to sensual pleasure of some sort or other. Ill will, you get caught in the orbit of ill will so powerfully that people do things that they regret for decades, maybe the rest of their life. And these things can happen so quickly that we lash out. An expression of anger and detrimental to ourselves, detrimental to our whole society. Maybe some of the terrible things we read in the newspaper, it's an interesting exercise, is to kind of look into them and see, was a person who did these terrible things, were they under the influence of one of the hindrances? Was greed, desire, you know, in the forefront that led them to do what they did? Was there anger or ill will that was there? Or was it, you know, something else, one of the other ones? So it's a wonderful thing to study these things. It's even better to become free of them. And so we study them in order to become free. If you want to become a good student of the hindrances, you have to be very patient with them and not be dismissive of them. You have to kind of, when they arise, you want to stop for them. The bumper sticker for these 6 weeks can be, I stop for the hindrances. It doesn't mean that you indulge in them or let them do what they want to do, but you become interested and you study them. What is desire? What is sensual desire? As if you've never really taken a good look at it. What is ill will? What is aversion? What happens here when my energy drops? Happens enough, what's going on there? What goes on when I get kind of revved up with restlessness and anxiety and doubt? What's going on there? I'm very fond of the word respect because it means kind of from Latin roots to look again. And so we respect all this stuff by taking a deeper look. What's going on? So that's the topic for these next weeks. And today I want to primarily introduce the five, and then the preceding weeks we'll do each hindrance for over 5 weeks. And as part of the introduction, I want to relate to you some beautiful analogies that the Buddha gave around these hindrances. And as I give these analogies, I'm reminded that I was driving over here today to how beautifully clear the sky was tonight, and we had a full moon. And the full moon and the clear sky is often taken as a symbol for a clear mind and a luminous mind, a mind that's settled, a mind that's not caught up not caught by things, not being pushed around by the winds of desire and ill will and thoughts and all that. So these analogies. If you want to see yourself well, which is one of the things we do in mindfulness, we want to really be able to see ourselves honestly, clearly, then we have the analogy of the Buddha gave of a bowl of water. Now, if you have you make a silver bowl or something and you have water in it, the water is really still. Perhaps if you look over the water, you can see your reflection. However, if you put a lot of food coloring into that water, so it's red or blue or something, then it's hard to see your reflection. If you heat up the pot and the water is boiling, you can't see very well your reflection. If you go down to the local pond and get a whole bunch of algae and slime, and you kind of put it on top of your wonderful little pot of water, you're not going to have your reflection. And if you put it out in a strong wind and the wind whips up the surface, then you're not going to have a reflection. And if you put a lot of mud in it, gets all muddy, you're not going to have a good reflection. So if you're caught up in sensual desire, it's like having your eyes or your ability to perceive colored with strong dye. And we all know that when you fall in love with someone, at least some of us, maybe not you particularly, but others. you fall in love with someone, you see them in rose-colored eyes, rose-colored glasses, and then just, you know, they can't do anything wrong. And then pendulum swings, and then, they become public enemy number one. And everything they do, everything about that person just seems like, is bad and irritating. Our mood can affect how we see things. And when we're caught in the grip of sensual desire, it's hard to see ourselves very clearly. When we're caught in the grip of anger or ill will, it can be like, we talk about the fever of the heat of anger, the fever of anger. So we kind of boiling and bubbling, the mind is kind of on hot. And in that situation also, it's hard to see ourselves clearly. If we're caught up in somehow in these energy-draining states, sloth and torpor, it can be like, sometimes it's described as having, kind of slogging through sludge. It's very hard to kind of do anything or see anything or activate the mind. And so it's like pond that's covered with algae. And it's very hard with all this algae and slime on top to make your way through the pond. You can't swim very well. You get all slimy. And then in the wind whipped surface of the pond is like when your mind is really agitated and restless, it's hard to see anything clearly as well because the mind is just spinning and fragmented and going this way and that, and you're not settled enough to see. And then doubt is like the muddy water. If you're really caught up in doubt, there's indecisiveness, uncertainty, don't know which way to turn, don't know what to do. And it can feel sometimes with doubt like there's no ability to move forward in what we're going to do. That's the first analogy. The second analogy the Buddha gave is that of a river. A strong, steady river where there's a current down the middle of the river, and that current is going straight down the length of the river, maybe out into the ocean. And someone comes along and opens up waterways on either side of the river, diverting some of the water this way and that way. And as this water is diverted, that current, mainstream current down the middle, also gets diverted. And it doesn't go out towards the ocean, but rather the current goes off into these side chutes, the waterways, the irrigation channels, and all these different places. So in this analogy, we can have a very strong purpose for our lives, something we want to do, whether it's to sit down and meditate, or it's to make some big difference in the world, help the world in some way, or all kinds of things. And that sense of purpose can be derailed or be siphoned off by being caught up in the hindrances. I'm somewhat in awe, certainly of my own mind at times. Sometimes I'm humored by it. It's said that if you can be... if you can be humored by your own mind, you'll never stop... Let's see, if you can laugh at yourself, you'll never stop being humored. So it's a good quality to have. So I can sit down to meditate. Meditation is really important for me, probably guessed. And I do a lot of it. I love it. And it feels very important. And central, kind of very central thing in my life. So I can sit down with this very important thing. Committed. I'm here. I'm going to do it. Nothing right at the moment seems more important to me. Okay, here I am. Okay, the breath. Thank you. One breath. Good. Two breath. Great, I'm on track. Three breath. Oh, it's going to be easy now. Yes. Fourth breath. Chocolate. I wonder what flavor chocolate we have in the refrigerator. Or, you know, pizza would be really good right now. I wonder what kind of flavor pizza. They have a new pizza place in Redwood City, and, you know, I should go try it. And, yeah, I wonder. They probably have thin crusts. Oh, what breath was I on? Third, fourth, fifth, where was I? So that sense of purpose I had got derailed by something as petty as pizza, or, you know, dare I say chocolate is petty? You know, derailed by it. And it really amazes me how a strong purpose, something that's really valuable, can be siphoned off by any one of these things. Another analogy the Buddha gave is that of gold. Gold is a valuable metal. Many people wish they had more of it these days. In order to be able to work gold, for it to become soft enough to work, it's necessary to take out the impurities. And if you take out the impurities, then it becomes soft and malleable and wieldy, and it can be shaped into something beautiful. Same thing with the mind. If you take out the impurities of the mind, then the mind stops being stiff and hard. But the mind then becomes soft, workable, wieldy, and can be shaped into something beautiful. So it's very hard to kind of work on your psychology, work on your issues, work on, you know, what motivates you, work on your dispositions, all kinds of things. If you're caught in the grip of anything, and particularly in the grip of the hindrances. And people wonder why they put so much effort into changing themselves, becoming a better person, not being so much influenced by their fear or their desire or their aversion or whatever, and they don't make any headway. They feel so solid there. It's because it is solid. The mind can kind of stiffen up. And it's also possible, however, to make them to free the mind of the impurities, and then the mind becomes more and more malleable and workable. It's a beautiful expression the Buddha used. Malleable, wieldy, and workable. So if you want to kind of transform your inner life, you have to have an inner life that can be transformed, that's soft enough for that. So these five hindrances are the impurities in the gold of your mind. And so if you can somehow free yourself of these impurities, then the mind becomes luminous, it becomes something really valuable, and something you can work with and do more with. The last analogy is a series of analogies, one for each of the five hindrances. The first hindrance is like being in debt. Somehow when you're focusing on desire and what you want, we're not really connected to ourselves, not really centered on ourselves, and you're in debt to yourself. And you feel like, you know, you have to, you know, you're not really satisfied until you get what you want, until something is satisfied, your debt is satisfied. That's my best attempt to explain the analogy. Then the second analogy for ill will or aversion is that, and this is kind of, I think it's a kind of a powerful image. The analogy for ill will here is having an illness. And maybe you can remember some time in your life or someone else you know who was so caught in anger and ill will that it's such a tremendous cost for the mind and the body that it's reasonable, you know, to call it almost like an illness, the effect on us. There was somewhere I read about an English gentleman, I think was a doctor in the 1700s, 1800s, who said, The next person who makes me angry will be the death of me. And it did. His anger was so powerful and such a big impact on his heart that, you know, it somehow he had a heart attack or something didn't work. So ill will as a illness. Sloth and torpor is, the image here is like being in jail. Restlessness and anxiety is like being a slave. So in jail, you can't get out and do something, can't do what you want to do, there's no freedom. Restlessness, you're being pushed around by all these powerful forces of the mind this way and that, and you have no control over it. So you're a slave. And doubt is like being lost in the desert. Now, this particular analogy has a flip side. And that is that if you're free of debt, it's expected, at least in this analogy, it's expected that you'll be happy, joyful. If you're freed of illness, the analogy expects you to be joyful, to be happy about that. If you're free of jail, you'll be happy about that. If you're free of slavery, you'll be happy about that. And if you've come to out of the dangerous desert into safety, then you'll be happy about that. When these five forces, so in meditation practice, when these five different forces are no longer operating, it can be such a relief. It can be so delightful, enjoyable, to feel like you have yourself back. To feel like, oh, I'm in charge. Oh, you know, I'm not being run over, yanked around, influenced by things I don't want to be influenced by, yanked around by things I don't want to be yanked around about by. And it can really feel nice. Wow, this is really nice. And in the teachings of the Buddha, you're actually encouraged to have this particular kind of joy, the joy of being free of the hindrances. That kind of joy reinforces the value of not wanting to be in the hindrances. Hopefully you get a sense of something better. That kind of joy is much better. And this is a difficult lesson to learn, especially in relationship to sensual desire. Because sensual desire usually has, more often than not, it involves some degree of fantasy, of thinking or ideas, what something's going to do for us. And often those fantasies can be pleasant fantasies. And so there's kind of a pleasure in having the fantasy. And there's a few people I've met who don't want to give up their fantasy for sensual pleasure because they're attached to that particular pleasure. Now, yeah, the pleasure of the fantasy, you know, more than the pleasure of actual, you know, whatever they want. So there certainly can be kind of pleasure there. And here, the Buddha is saying there's a different kind of pleasure that he would call a joy, relief, delight, that comes when the mind is free of these, the gravitational force of these powerful forces in the mind. And so if you can feel that deep sense of well-being, that relief that can come from that, and you know that's better than the delight or the pleasure of fantasy, then the mind will more likely want to go towards this place of freedom. It's a beautiful thing. The sky, with the full moon, the clear evening sky with the full moon, is beautiful. A mind which is set free, clear, sky-like expansiveness, freed of clouds and wind and fog and smog and all the city lights. It's quite beautiful to see all these stars. It's a beautiful thing. It isn't that we want that kind of beauty for its own right, for its own purpose in Buddhism, but that kind of clarity sets the stage for us to be able to see something really clearly. Just like when the sky is clear at night, and you can see the full moons clearly, then you can, in a sense, study the full moon. You can get a really powerful telescope and study it and discover what it's like. When the mind is settled and freed of the hindrances, then we can look much, much more deeply into the functioning of our mind and some of the subtle ways in which we hold on, are attached, we cling, we resist, we're afraid. We can look deeper into the very roots of what makes us tick in a way that's very, very difficult to do when the mind is continually caught up in all these things. So, another thing I want to say as an introduction to these hindrances is the first four are paired. And it's interesting to see how they're paired. Sensual desire and ill will, even though they're kind of subjective states, the focus is on the object of desire, the object of the ill will. And we're often pulled into that object, that person, that thing we want, or whatever. And they're kind of focused on object in different ways. Desire wants the object. Ill will wants to attack it or push it away or get away from it. So opposite kind of directions, the motivation, the wanting. Often with these sensual desire and ill will, we get caught up in thinking about the object, the person, whatever it might be. And one of the interesting, very important things to do in mindfulness meditation is to learn how to not necessarily stop having desire or ill will, but to turn the attention 180 degrees around and feel what it's like subjectively to be caught in desire or caught in ill will. If we're blinded by the object, we're not going to notice what the subjective state is like. And it's easier with ill will. Ill will, you can see that when you really pay attention to what the cost is for you, it's not worth it. So the Buddha said, you do your enemy a favor if you're angry with your enemy, because then you're doing a harm for yourself that your enemy could never manage to do on his or herself. Did I say that right? You got the point? So you do this inner harm to yourself when you're angry, and only you can do that. The enemy can't do that. With desire, it's harder to see the cost. But go on a long meditation retreat, like a week. And I don't recommend getting caught up in sensual desire fantasies. But if it does happen, meditation retreat's a great place to study it. Because sometimes it can go on for, you know, daily life, you can have a fantasy and then the television rings or you have to go to work or, you know, there's all this, reality interferes. On retreat, there's very little reality to interfere. And you're sitting there meditating. And the mind can just kind of somehow get locked in sometimes on some really good fantasy. And it can go on and on for hours sometimes. And after hours sometimes, a person might finally notice, this is a drag. This is exhausting. This is a waste of time. The seduction of that pleasure is really at a detriment to myself. I was fooled by it. But sometimes it takes you several hours to kind of where it finally kind of dawns on the person, wow, what a trip. So desire and ill will are kind of opposite directions of wanting. And then sloth and torpor and restlessness and anxiety, they're also paired. One has to do with a dropping of energy, and the other has to do with the agitated energy, kind of upping of energy level. Here the focus tends to be more than a subjective state. There's something that makes us agitated, something that may make us sloth and torporful, but it's more, and then we're more tuned in to how we feel. And so it's up or down with the energy. And doubt doesn't need to be paired. It just, you know. It's said that doubt is the most dangerous of the hindrances. Now, another way of looking at these five hindrances is that sometimes they are strategies that we use, that our mind uses, when we're challenged. We're challenged by uncomfortable things. So things are uncomfortable, difficult. Some people's default is to go into desire mode. Sitting here in meditation, your knee hurts, this is a drag, my back hurts, I'm bored. I wonder what it would be like to go on vacation. Maybe I can go to vacation down there on the Santa Cruz Boardwalk in summer and be in the sand, and how wonderful it would feel for the sand through my toes. Ah, it'd be so good. And the breeze against my cheek. And it's a fantasy, a desire fantasy, that's a strategy to get away from the discomfort of being here and now. Some people are really good at this. Other strategies is to lash out. There are people who are really good at blaming. You know, find what's wrong out there. I'm uncomfortable. So the story I like to tell is when my son was a year and a half, I think. I forget exactly how old. A year and a half or two. I had a cold. Mild cold. And it was raining. Mild rain. And UPS came with an unexpected gift from someone, which was a big box, which was a big plastic, like maybe 4 foot high, play structure, like a little fort with a slide. And the instructions said, assembles in 10 minutes. So I unpacked it and went out into the yard in the rain with my cold and started assembling it. And after about a half an hour or so, I finally managed to bang these pieces together. And only then did I notice how exhausted I was. Because I had a cold, right? They just like drained me. So I did a completely reasonable thing. When I noticed, I'm getting worse now, maybe I'm getting more sick. Completely reasonable. At least in some people's minds, this would be reasonable. I blamed UPS. For bringing me that box. So I saw that go on my mind, and the next instant I laughed at myself. That was ridiculous. Blaming UPS for bringing a box, I had to take responsibility for going out there in the rain. And then I saw that being a little bit sick and having been housebound for a few days, I was kind of bored. That was where I was being challenged by my boredom. And so I wanted entertainment. There was desire there. And so I went out to pursue my desire to get some relief from my cabin fever. And to my detriment. When I noticed it was my detriment and I felt lousy, then I lashed out at someone else. Someone else is responsible. So it's a strategy. I'm talking about strategies some people have. So, or I'm sitting here and meditating and my knee hurts, and rather than thinking about the sand in Santa Cruz, I think about all the creative ways in which I could slash and burn my zafu, my meditation cushion. Because something, needs the full onslaught of my fury. Sloth and torpor sometimes comes because we're tired or who knows why, but sometimes it's a strategy of resistance, of lethargy, of not being engaged, pulling back. And you see it really well in children. And in my situation, I call it my Sears mind, the Sears department store. Because when I was a kid, my mom sometimes would take me to Sears to buy me clothes. And I hated it. I hated the smell. I hated the whole thing. And I would get so tired. Oh, I can't go. No, I can't. Not now. I'm too tired. Oh, this is hard. Try on those pants. Oh. And it was a sad story. But then, at the end of this very grueling and taxing childhood trauma, my mother would say something like, should we go out and get some ice cream? I had all the energy in the world. where did it come from? I wasn't tired anymore. So it was a strategy of resistance, sloth and torpor. We shut down because we're challenged by the situation. Some people in challenging situations just get all agitated, restless, start running around in circles. They don't know where to stand. Got to do this, got to do that, fix this. You know, just problem solve, going this way and that way. They don't know what foot to stand on. And they worry, endlessly worry. And that's a strategy to cope. And then some people, their strategy is just to kind of fall back into uncertainty, indecisiveness, doubt. This is difficult. I don't know whether to go forward or backwards. I don't know what to do here. And rather than it being kind of wise not knowing, it's taking refuge in not knowing, because then we don't have to make a decision. We don't have to do anything. So it's very interesting to look at these hindrances as strategies as well. They're almost like natural forces in the mind that can come up for no particular good reason. But they can also be very powerfully connected to something deeper going on in us. So we call them the five hindrances in English. They could also be called the five coverings. And a whole other approach to studying these five hindrances is to ask or to look into, what are they covering over? Desire can be covering over loneliness. Ill will can be covering over frustrated desire. Sloth and torpor can be covering over fear, maybe, which is so frightened by situation we just shut down. Restlessness and anxiety can be could be covering over. Here's an interesting reason: wanting to be approved and liked. A little bit strange, maybe connection. But I've known people who said that in our family, we showed love by worrying for each other. And the better you worried, the more people knew that you cared for them. So that's rather unfortunate way of showing your love. But, you know, so it's a strategy. And doubt, what is that covering over? Maybe fear. Fear of commitment, fear of doing something. So there's a lot of things it could cover. But so sometimes it's interesting to look more deeply. What is it that's covering? If this wasn't here, this hindrance, what would I have to face? What would I have to deal with right now? So, I believe I said a lot today. I apologize if this was too much information, too much all at once. But I wanted to kind of lay out the terrain. And then I'll tell a story to end. We have 5 minutes. But before the story, I want to say, as we go through these weeks, the pace will slow down quite a bit from today. And we'll spend a whole day on sensual desire and ill will. And as you reflect on this over the week, you might reflect, think about yourself, and think of which of these five might be your default hindrance. Which of these best characterizes you? Which of them is most likely for you to appear when you're challenged? Which of these is more likely to show up or shows up more often in meditation? Start to see if you start noticing patterns and see which ones tend to be more your, you know, your thing. And don't take it personally. You know, as a personal failing. You know, it's kind of like, good way of thinking about this is that everyone needs to be a, you know, type. And you just happen to be the desire type, the ill will type, or the sloth and torpor type. And that's what you get to work with. Okay? Here's a story. In that special monastery, once upon a time, there was a nun who lived there for many years. And she taught the monks. And she was very wise and a great teacher. Trained many of the monks. They became quite mature in their spiritual life. But at some point she got old. And she decided that it was time for her to retire. And to retire in the mountain hermitage, which was a 2.5-day walk deep in the mountains away from the monastery. So she did. But because she was so wise, people loved to go see her. And people would do the 2.5-day trek to see her, get some advice, tell her story about the story, and she'd listen and get some advice. And then she would, and then they'd walk 2.5 days out. When they came out and they saw people, everyone would say the same thing. They'd say, "Wow, she's really wise. She said just the right thing for me." I don't know how she knew knew me so well, but she knew just the right thing to say to me. Got right to me, and it's really good. But she had one particular condition, however, before she told me my advice. The condition for getting the advice was I was not to tell anyone ever what advice I was given. And what she said when people came to see her, she had the same thing to say to everyone. And what she said was, "What are you unwilling to pay attention to?" Some people were disappointed when they got that at first. But after 2.5 days of trekking out, walking out of the mountains, by the time they got out, they realized that was the perfect thing for them. So that's a secret for each of you. What is it you're unwilling to pay attention to? Okay. Thank you.